I'll tell you something I love about being in France, in addition to some seriously delicious butter, and that is the wide selection of wines I can find in France for low prices. It can be much more difficult to source those same bottles back in the States, and that's why I love to buy wines out of France with Ideal Wine. I have bottles shipped to me, hassle-free. It's easy. Ideal Wine has a new auction every week and is a great source for iconic names like Ouette, Louis Roeder, and Domaine Lefleuve, as well as rising stars like Arnaud Lachaud, Gonon, and Tissot. Find the wines you'd rather be drinking at idealwine.com. That's IDEALWINE.com and have the wine shipped to you in the States. Use the promo code FIRST, FIRST, for $15 off your first order of $150 or more. Hey, that's $15 you could save, and that is some good butter money. See for yourself at Ideal Wine.
I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today.
Glass. It's such an important factor in the wine business, and we take glass for granted these days, as it is plentiful and easy to get. But glass wasn't always such a part of wine trade and consumption, and in a way, the last several centuries of winemaking have really run in parallel with advancements in glass technology. Glass beads were being produced as early as 2500 BC, but Egyptian glass vessels began to be created around 1500 BC. Egyptian glass was only for the pharaohs and the nobles. Around 300 BC, Syrians invented a pipe for blowing glass. And the craft of glassblowing was born. During the Roman Empire, glassmaking flourished. It went everywhere the Romans went, just like grapevines. And the main hub of glassmaking was based in the now German city of Cologne, or Köln. But as the Roman Empire slowly fell, glassmaking faded away, it became less valued, and many of the once embraced methods of producing glass had been lost or forgotten. But not in Venice. In Venice, glassmaking was a secret profession. Glassmakers, the Glassmakers Guild, and the families of glassmakers were exiled to Murano Island. You see, the smoke and fires they needed to produce glass, it wouldn't disrupt the city life there. And also, the secrets of glassmaking could be heavily guarded. The secrets were considered so valuable that glassmakers and their family members were forbidden to leave the island, with the risk of death if they were caught elsewhere. And yet, wherever there is oppression, there are usually those who manage to escape it. A few rogue glassmakers were able to escape Murano, and they brought their craft to other areas of Europe. But why would they leave when faced with death if they were caught? Well, other governments wanted glass so badly that they offered serious incentives. For instance, if a Venetian glassmaker brought their secrets to France, they were exempt from all taxes, and they could gain expedited citizenship. Glassmaking was shrouded in secrecy until the 1600s when Antonio Neri published the book, The Art of Glass. In part due to Neri's book, glassmaking became a large part of the Renaissance. And during this period, we saw an increase in glassmaking technology that not only affected the wine world, but it also helped Galileo find lenses for his telescopes. And it helped near and far-sighted people to have better spectacles. Things really changed when Venetian glassblowers traveled throughout Europe and spread their craft. Where did they go? They created forest glass houses. Forest glass houses became popular in Europe. Because glassmakers needed large amounts of wood, they usually set up in forests, and their products varied based on the different compositions of ash they could render from the particular plants and trees in their area. Now, as a glassmaker cleared the surrounding forest from their forest glasshouse, people would move in to cultivate the cleared land, and entire ecosystems and agricultural hubs were changed. Glasshouses tended to move around because once they exhausted the wood in a particular part of a forest, they'd move on to new forests. Glasshouses produced one item in particular of great importance, rumers. It's R-O-U-M-L-A-U-T, M-E-R-S. Rumers are the ancestors of the modern-day wine glass, and they were used for wine and ale consumption. Early rumers looked like fancy small jars or cups with glass bases. But over the centuries, rumers became increasingly complex, and elaborate pedestals for the cup became attached to the bottoms. In England, they had deforestation issues, and soon glassmakers were experimenting with different methods of heat, such as coal. This made English glass different. It was darker and stronger, and great for shipping liquids. This gave them a leg up in the bottle market. In 1676, things changed again when lead glass was invented. George Ravenscroft worked in Venice for many years, but he secretly made glass in England. And his invention of lead glass is sort of the beginning of the story of the modern wine glass. Lead glass stays pliable when it's hot, much longer than non-lead glass. And this allowed glass blowers to make different shapes more easily. Shape and form began to be more important. Whereas in the past, glassmakers were idealized for their embellishments and decorations. But with lead glass, the aesthetic began to change toward unembellished glass in unique forms. The idea of a pencil-thin glass stem on a glass cup, though commonplace today, is a relatively contemporary idea. More recently, the Industrial Revolution saw many things that moved glass from a craft to a commodity, such as the tank furnace, automatic glass blowing machines, and glass molds for mass bottle production. These inventions brought wine glasses and bottles into the homes of everyday people. Today, the modern wine glass market seems to be an interesting hybrid of craft and industry, with large-scale craft production driving much of the high-end wine glass market. So the next time you toast and drink out of a glass wine glass, think of what it must have been like living in exile on the island of Murano near Venice.
It's not enough to make great wine. You also have to reach the consumer that appreciates that wine. And that's where Offset is an incredible asset. Offset is an independent brand design and commerce technology company that connects with wineries on a human level to help them connect with consumers on a human level. Offset is based in wine country and staffed by creative strategists and technologists who are superb at helping create and evolve wine brands through visual identity and package design, developing the look, feel, and tone of your web content, as well as building beautiful and effective websites powered by their proprietary e-commerce platform, Offset Commerce. That's why leaders like Frog's Leap, Grace Family Vineyards, and Rain Winery already rely on Offset. Reach out to the brilliant team at Offset at offsetpartners.com. That's OFFSET. Partners with an S .com. Offset is focused on the wine industry and can embrace the nuanced needs of your wine brand. Marco Palanti of Castello d'Ama on the show today. Hello, sir. How are you?
Fine, thank you very much.
Very nice to have you here.
I'm happy to be here to speak about my job, my life.
So you're a winemaker and owner at Castello d'Ama in Gaiole these days?
Yes, I am a winemaker since 1982. It's my first harvested, and after I married one of the daughter of the owner, and so I have co-owner with my wife.
A beautiful move. Nice move on your part.
Yeah, beautiful move.
Good strategy.
Because, Overall, because when I find that this place is a friend of mine to give me in the property, said me, hey, there is a property in near Gaiola. It's called Fattoria di Ama. Do you know? No, I don't know. But they are looking for a young guy to give the car, the house. No, this is impossible. They are waiting me. So after house and car, I found also the wife. And so it's really a movie.
But you had been a professional, like, kayaker. You'd been a sportsman.
Yeah, I come from sport. I'm very competitive in my thing. I would like to do my best in everything. And so when I start to make wine is to produce the great wine. I don't like to make wine only to produce wine. This is my objective.
So you arrived at Castello d'Ama in 1982. And yeah. What was the history of the place before that?
Before was the owner, the actual owner, bought the property in the early 70s. Was four family come from Rome. They don't know the wine. They love the place. To be in the middle between Siena and Florence was a dream. The place is the most beautiful thing, the most very attractive. During the first year, one of these associated start to know the Bordeaux wine. And so he convinced the other to invest. In the middle of 70, a great part of the vineyard was planted. In the 79, a fantastic cellar was finished, because when I arrived in 82, the cellar was amazing because it's completely steel with the control of the temperature. It was really, it's something up to date today. And so at that time was really a vineristic cellar. And after this, they start to look for a young winemaker to invest also on him, because I have studied French to go to the University of Bordeaux. I did my specialization in winemaker in Bordeaux, because I'm graduated in agriculture in Italy. At the time, it didn't exist a specific university for winemaking in Italy. And so my studies, I did abroad Italy.
And you had been to Bordeaux, and did you meet Patrick Leon there?
Yeah, he's a friend of the property, and this is very important for my first years, because it was an amazing man, give me the possibility to enter in the best chateau of the world in the early 80s, and was important for me, because I try to understand everything and to give with me what I can. And Patrick was very important also in terms of testing, because we test one each year together, and was very important really for the quality and for overall for the my imprinting in winemaking.
What was he like in person?
He's a very serious man, and he have a lot of culture in wine. He know every wine, because before Mouton, he worked with Alexis Lechine, and so he has the possibility to test the wine overall from French, but also for the other part of the world. And he did together with Mondavi the first Opus One, and so he's a fantastic a leader for me to understand better, to enter. I think it's the best enter I can desire, because I enter for the first door, it's not for the second door.
He was working as a consultant with Castello d'Ama, and what did he tell you about Sangiovese?
Sangiovese, he loved the fruity of the Sangiovese, the freshness. At the beginning, he had some doubt for the consistency in terms of aging of the wine. He saw in the wine the similar characteristic of the cru Beaujolais.
Oh, okay.
It is not so far. If you have in your head The Cru Beaujolais, for example, is wine you can drink after 5-8 years. It's good, fresh, clean, without not too much oak. And I think it's not so far. And it was very... And little discover together the potential of the grapes. Because when I start to produce wine, it was incredible. It's very hard if you found a Chianti Classico drinkable after 5 years.
At that time, in the 80s.
At the time, we use the disciplinary for the Chianti Classico permits us to use between 10 and 30% of white grapes. And this 30% is a percentage not in grapes, but in vines. And so you have in your vineyard 30%.
Really? In vines.
And you know the production of Uni Blanc is bigger than Sangiovese. And so you have 30% in vines, and sometimes you arrive to have 35 or 40% of white grape. I remember one thing was my first contact with the University of Bordeaux. Daniel Bourdieu, you know, is a French professor at that time, and explained me in the class the possibility to make wine red and white and rosé. And he said the white wine you can produce with the white grapes or also with the red grapes. The red wine you have to produce with the red grapes. And watch me, I said, only the Italians said it's possible to produce red wine with the white grapes.
All the Italians put their hand up in the air and like, professor.
Yeah, it was the first contact. But it was really beautiful. But I agree with him because at that time, one of the problems of the Chianti is the acidity, and is the white give more acidity. And the tannins, and together become orange very fast and very aggressive. And this is a problem, the great problem of the past Chianti Classico.
So who were producers in Gaiole in the 80s? Who was there when you started?
At the time, the best producer was Badia Coltibono is one, or Broglio, unfortunately, in that time is not the best period for this property because pass hand by hand, and so we lose a little bit the appeal of the region. Is a problem because for us Broglio is like our Chateau Margaux, is a good example, is a great example because the history passed for Broglio, of course. After Coltibuono in the Gaiole region, we have no more great producer. I think more of the best now starting in that period, like San Giusto Rentennano, like Il Palazzino, like have a lot of small producer start to produce a good wine. We have other producer, important producer, but not only in Gaiole, in every other part of Chianti. For me, I love, for example, Felsina is one of my favorite wine. Start more or less in the same years, so probably in the late 70s. But anyway. And Fonterutoli start to produce good wine at that time. Castellinvilla, there is a lot of, and of course also Montevertino. I don't know if I can speak about Montevertino because he didn't produce any Chianti Classico, but he's a producer of Chianti Classico, and so he started to produce very well. He did the decision to produce out of the denomination, but in terms of concentration to produce quality is one of the most important, small but important.
And I think originally he did produce Chianti Classico, like the first few years.
The first few years, yes, but more or less we have, if I compare my history with the history of Sergio Manetti, we have the two completely opposite line philosophy, because we involve our force in the production of Chianti Classico. We are the first to introduce the Cru Compset, for example. In 78 was born our first vineyard selection, Vigneto Bella Vista. And in the same times, he started to produce Montevertine like a singular flag is not into the region. Yeah, it's product into the region, but it's not with the name of the Chianti Classico. And so it's interesting because after 30 years, we can say we are arrived, have the success, but with two completely different streets. And this is interesting. The dimension is different, but anyway, the powerful of the brand, I think, in this moment is more or less, you can compare.
Was there something that was happening inside Italy that you think caused change to happen in the 80s, that interesting estates started to open in the late 70s and 80s or revitalize at the time?
In the 80s, the strange people discovered the beauty of the place. I think Chianti...
You mean people from outside the area?
...is helped by the beauty. Because I was at the university in the middle of 70, and at that time, if you speak about Chianti, said Chianti have not future because...
As a wine.
Yeah, it's impossible to have a good mechanization because the stones, the hill, it's very hard to do that. And at that time, we study everything to have a good mechanization, to reduce the cost. And so the problem of the Chianti was really, what is the future of this region? Montalcino was not born, for example, at that time. Exists only Biondi Santi. Is some rare producer, but in terms of region, is not so strong. And so arrived the people from Milan, from Rome, and also from abroad, and believe in this place, and start to plant the vines, and as we do, for example, as we did, try to discover what is the real possibility of the traditional variety before. And so, finally, the Sangiovese was cultivated in a good way, but not only Sangiovese, also Canaiolo, for example, and also the white grapes, to discover if the quality of the wine is really the maximum we can do, or we can improve more quality. My first 10 years was in this direction. In the between 82 and 90, I produced 19 different labels of wines, and 5 different labels of white is incredible. One, Trebbiano Malvasia, for the tradition, and I work these two varieties like the Chardonnay and Champagne. In the best way. And after we discovered the possibility of this wine, I said the Trebbiano is good when past the Alpi and you distill and become Garmagnac. or Malvasia Bianca is good if you dried to produce a Vinsanto, but to produce the white grapes is very, very difficult. And so we surgrafted different new varieties, Chardonnay, Sauvignon, Pinot Gris, a little part of Riesling. Anyway, to understand and overall to try to look for each place the best grapes. Each parcel have to produce a good wine. And so we need to make the white because not all the property have the good disposition for the red. We have another problem, if you want, is the altitude. Ama is around 500 meters on the sea level, and this is a characteristic very important to understand the character of my wine. But at the same time, is a very difficult characteristic because if 500 meters, if you don't plant the Sangiovese in the best position, you can have some problem in some years because in not years you have a good ripeness. And Sangiovese without good ripeness have the very bad tannins. Is aggressive. Is green. Is acid. And so, you need to do this kind of work. And so, in the early 80s, my first work is this. We surgrafted because another problem we found is in the same parcel, the consortium said you have to plant all the variety of the Chianti Classico. And so I found in the same parcel the red Sangiovese, but with the Trebbiano, Malvasia, Canaiolo all together. And you know, it's impossible when you make the harvest, or you pass 3-4 times in the same parcel, or you put everything together, and sometimes something is overripe, some other is not ripe, and so it's not the right project to produce wine, quality wine. And so we surgrafted. We start with surgrafted, and we surgrafted to have a good homogenization for parcel to parcel, someone with the Sangiovese, some other with the white or with other. And at that time, we introduced new variety. Between 82 and 87, I surgrafted 50,000 vines.
That's quite a bit.
It's quite, is a huge quantity of hectares. You know, at that time, the density is 2,800, 3,000 vines each hectares. And so 50,000 was really, we changed completely the surface of the property. And other things we did at that time is to found another trailing system can give us more maturity. In Rale, l'Institut National Recherche Agronomique of Bordeaux have just finished to study the Lyra system. You know, Lyra system is for the musical instruments, and so you have the double of leaves each vines. And if you imagine the leaves like a solar panel, you have the double of solar panel. And if you produce the same quantity of grapes, you have better maturity. It's very simple. The problem is very expensive because you have to pass double for each vines, and I mean, this is a problem. But anyway, that system was very important because give us the possibility to produce quality grapes after 1-2 years, and this is very, very, very important for us. We transform 24 hectares in Lyra. And so I said, I found the cellar, but in the country we have to work a lot. And the first 10 years is dedicated, completely, entirely dedicated to improve more quality to the grapes. This is a great secret of the French wine at that time.
The grape material.
Yeah, the raw material. If you have the good raw material in the cellar, after this your work is only a control. You have... It's like when a baby was born, no? You wait the baby out, but you don't did nothing. And this is my work and my philosophy, and this is the philosophy remain also today because I continue to work in this sense. Ama, for example, I said is 500 meters and very, very calcareous soil. If you understand these two characteristics, you can understand better the characteristic of the wine. Because my wine, you drink first of all with the nose. It's a perfume, it's beautiful perfume. And the freshness, because the acidity is a little bit more higher compared to other part, more lower. And in the same times, I have the softness of the tannins. This is a characteristic of all my wine. The color... It's deep, but it's not deep. It's not black. It's like a good Pinot Noir. No, it's a good density, a good good color, but it's not black like Cabernet Sauvignon, for example, or like Syrah, for example. But it's not important. This is the characteristic of my grapes and my wine. What I try to do is to respect this origin and try to do my best. And after I propose to the market and. After this, you love or you don't love my wine. This is another question. But if you are looking for fresh Chianti Classico, good balance, very elegant and sweet tannins, this is the right place. If you are looking for the wine, powerful, colored, this is not the right place to find it. This is what we have to say to the customer in this moment, because the problem is not the goodness. The goodness is not my... Is not my. I haven't this problem. The goodness is like a problem because the goodness for me is not my finality. It's a medium. It's a medium to explain you my terroir. The wine have to be good, otherwise it's impossible to sell, of course. But at the same time, I respect the origin, and after this, I propose. Otherwise, for me, it's very difficult to recognize the boundary between the beverage and the wine. In this moment. This line is very difficult to understand. If, for example, if I ask you what kind of wine you want, and prepare this wine for you. This is wine or a beverage?
Sounds to me more like a beverage.
It's more beverage. Can be also good, but it's another thing. And this is what you can find very easily on the market. It's very difficult in this moment to find the bad wine. You find, generally speaking, good wine, but without soul, nothing to say you, because it's only good. And good have the same project of Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola have to be good, but my project is not to be good. Goodness is a medium. It's important, but it's a medium.
So what about those sweet tannins? That you said that that's a hallmark of yours. Where did that philosophy come from? And is that a factor of where you're working or what you're working with or how?
Of course, it's very important the science, the technology, because every new step in this sense is only because the technology grow up. Otherwise, they know what we know now about the tannins is not the same things we know in the 80. Little we discover if we work in certain sense during the harvest, if we test the skin on the seeds before the harvest, we can decide that the harvest in function of this, on the character of the tannins. And so with these new things, we can arrive to make a very, very sweet tannins without anymore. That's all. It's only you can do some pumping over, for example, more in the first part of the fermentation, a little bit later you reduce, or in terms of temperature of maceration, it's better if you maintain the same temperature during all the maceration, also when the fermentation was finished. And so with this new work, we arrive to produce a very sweet tannins, very, very soft, and we don't like the aggression by the tannins. The tannins is important. This is one of the most important things I discovered in 82 when I have been the first time at University of Bordeaux, because in Italy sometimes said this wine is impossible to drink now because you can drink this after 20 years. I arrived in Bordeaux and I test Margaux, Mouton, the other is very good also when was young. It's very drinkable also when was young. And this is a great discover for me. And I try to arrive to make this. And I think finally we are more close now than in the past.
So in many ways, AMA has stayed the same in the sense that it's the same winemaking facility. It's the same winemaker you for a number of years, over 30 years. But at the same time, a lot of experimentation in the vineyard, a lot of replanting, as you mentioned already, and a number of different bottlings or different focuses on different bottlings. What are some of the things that you made in the past that you don't make now?
It's very difficult things. For example, in the first 10 years, the objective is arrive to understand how is the characteristic of the tannins of the Sangiovese, because I said before, we don't know really, and so we have to work in the better way to have a good extraction. But the problem is have this extraction. We have 2 years very important, not only for me, I think for all the Chianti Classico. 85 and 88 was two amazing vintage. The best harvest of 80, probably also 82, but was my first, and so I can do
hard
better.
Hard to know at the time.
Probably now I can do better. But anyway, 85 and 88, and in 85 and in 88, we discover the characteristic of the tannins of the Sangiovese. We discover the quantity of the tannins the Sangiovese can have. And so when arrived the 90, the first three harvests in the was a good moment for all the producer of Chianti, because if you test now, for example, 88, not only my wine but also the wine of the property I said before, you discover the elegance. And after the 90, the Sangiovese, the Chianti Classico, is becoming very elegant, very sweet, very round. And before, probably the tannins of the 85 is good now, but at that time it was really still aggressive, still a little bit present. After 88, we reduce, and with the 90, we arrive to produce very, very good wine. For me, 90 is a very familiar stones for the Chianti Classico history.
So you feel like you had certain vintages, and those vintage experiences influenced your future style.
Yeah, yeah, sure, sure. The 90 was one of these. The other, in the recent harvest, for example, 2007, because we discover the global warming, because we arrive to make the harvest very early compared to the past, and this is a great surprise for us. Some work in the vineyard we did in the 80s and the 90s, now we didn't. Because, for example, take off the leaves in front of the grapes with the last harvest, very hot. With the some years, the summer arrived very early. We need to have the leaves, and we don't work in this sense. And so it's 30 years I work, but every year is for me a secret. My fear when I start the harvest is to recognize very early the possibility of the raw material. I have to work in this sense. I have to understand early how I have to work, because I can have an idea, I can have a recipe to work, but my comparison is with the grape. When I arrive in front of the grape, I have to understand, okay, with this I can work how I want. With other, I have to change. Otherwise, our job is to catch on to the grape the best every year. Sometimes this best is a great dimension, the great millésime, for example. Sometimes the best is in a small dimension. But in terms of agreeability, have to be the same. The wine have to be good in the bad and in the great years. The difference is only in terms of aging. Some wine can age it more, some other can age it less. But that's all. You have to, if you understand this possibility, the real possibility of each grapes, you can produce great wine in every year. Of course, not the same quantity. This is another question. But for us, this is our job. Is our job. For example, we have had in the 2003 very difficult years. Was 2001, 2002, 2003. 2001 because we have had the snow on Easter, and we lose 30-35% of the production. After this, the weather is becoming not so terrible, but not so fantastic, but becoming fantastic after July, August, September, and October. Sun, sunny, beautiful, and so few production, better weather, and the year was amazing. But the production is very small. Usually, I produce around 150 at the time, 150,000 bottle, and that time I produce less 100,000, and so we reduce 30% less. 2002, everyone remember 2002 is really a disaster for not only for Italy but for the Europe. Burgundy, because 2002 in Burgundy is fantastic year. But we have rain in every month in July, in August, and September, and so the production was very, very few. We tried to do my best, and in the end we didn't produce, for example, any Aparita, any Merlot, and I put all our best lots in the Chianti Classico, and we stopped the blend when the quality you can compare with the 3 years before, 1999, 2000, 2001. And in 2002, I produced only 70,000 bottles. And so, 2001, 90,000. to 70,000. And 2003 is a very dry year. It's a year of the very, very dry, and we reduce a lot of the production. So if you take these 3 years together, we lose the production of 1 year. This is the problem. And I never said before, but we produce only by own vineyard. We don't purchase any grapes, any wine, and so this is can be a problem for the economy of the producer.
You mentioned Burgundy. You had traveled there a few years ago. How did that affect your viewpoint?
I love the passion of the Burgundy. I love the respect of the origin, the respect of the tradition. It was really amazing for me discover this great producer remain so connected with the soil. One time I have been to Madame Le Fleuve, and he stayed for one day with me and speak about the biodynamic, speak about the, in so passionate way. It's amazing. It's not necessary if she speaks of this, because the wine was beautiful. It's biodynamic or not biodynamic. It was perfect wine. I love this wine. But she speaks why and how she arrived to produce this wine. It was a good lesson, a great lesson for me.
Were there any other lessons that you took back from that trip?
Another important lesson is they know better than all the producers in the world, the characteristic of the grape place by place. They controlled for 100 years the same parcel, and they say, for example, the line where you can have the freezer, or the line or you can have more claimstone under soil, or more dry. And this is the parcelization we haven't in this moment in the Chianti Classico, and they need more producers start to do this in singular way. Each of us know what is the best place, but we need more time. This is a problem. in the winemaking, the time is very, very important. In this moment, we need more time to know better our soil. After this, we can do the same. We could do the same parcelization of the Burgundy, because Chianti need this kind of solution. Because when we speak about Chianti Classico, we haven't only one Chianti Classico, you know. The character of the Bordeaux is a good teacher for us, but we are not so similar to Bordeaux, because the soil is not so up and down like us. The variety,
the elevations change more.
The elevation change
in Tuscany, in Chianti Classico,
exactly. And the variety is completely different. Cabernet is more strong. Sangiovese is more similar to the Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir, Sangiovese makes Brunello, Nobile, Chianti, cioè, makes a lot of different wine in the same region. Because change the face when you plant in Montalcino or when you plant in Gaiola. And this is very important. This is a value for me of our variety, but we have to discover, to know better. Probably this is impossible to discover only one generation. We need more. We start to do something, but the future is of our guys.
For a number of years, in addition to working at Castelldama, you're also the head of the Consorzio of Chianti Classico producers. What was that experience like, looking at the region as a whole?
More or less six years ago, I started in 2006, 2012, is two times. Was a very important experience for me, because it's the first time I worked, because I finished my study at the university and after I started to work in AMA. And so I never had an experience like this. And was a beautiful experience, because we have this kind of comparison with more producer, bigger, more bigger, very, very small producer. and was really a good things. We tried to do something, but you know, when you are a lot of people, because the consortium of Chianti Classico is the most important in terms of number, is the most important consortium of Italy. In terms of surface, no, because Asti is more bigger, but the producer of Asti is less than the producer of Chianti Classico. We are around 600 producer, and half of this, more or less, put the wine in the bottle. And so have 350 producer directly from the grapes since the bottle. And it's not easy to find the something to organic to all together
consensus.
The consensus, total consensus, is very difficult. We spoke a lot about the appellation, the communal appellation. We are spoke about the zonazione, cioè to devise it like Burgundy. But anyway, is a great problem, and have to speak a lot before to start. The unique things we did is a new appellation, new classification we did and start a few months ago with the Chianti Classico, Riserva, and Gran Selezione. We introduced this new concept of the Gran Selezione because we try to make the difference between the who purchased, who didn't purchase any grapes and any liter of wine.
I see.
And this is important, I think, for the customer. This is not, if you want, it's not the classification in terms of quality, because sometimes it's better the wine from the industry. But the customer with this classification know if both this wine is totally product in the property. And this is, I think this is important.
So Gran Selezione means?
Gran Selezione means, yeah, the name, probably we will find something more beautiful. This is a little Spanish name, but to give an idea of this, and overall, because Gran Selezione can be the first step, because the second step you can put the name of the common, and so this is Gran Selezione from Gaiola, Gran Selezione from Radda, Gran Selezione. A little, I think we can arrive to have the great identity, common for common, and the different style can a little be more homogenized for the control of the customer, I think. And this is can be something, but of course we can do more, but for the moment this is just enough for us.
So what does that imply? The Gran Selezione is the one with no purchase grapes?
No, Gran Selezione is, allora, you have, first is the Chianti Classico, regular Chianti Classico.
Sure.
Regular Chianti Classico is the wine you drink early, can put in the bottle 1 year later the harvest, and so it's, for example, it's 2012 in this moment, and is a wine drinkable easily. Second level is the Riserva. The Riserva exists also before, but after the DOCG, the control of the to have the DOCG is only one control, and so you put your bottle to the control, and they say yes, and after this you decided if this wine can be regular or Riserva, no more control, and so you can find, for example, in the past some Riserva only because the wine is remaining 24 months in the cellar and is becoming a Riserva, but not because this Riserva have really more quality compared to the basic wine. And so in this moment now, you have to say, this is my bottle, you test my bottle for Riserva, or you test my bottle only for basic wine. And so in this sense, also for the customer, will found on the market better wine to the level Riserva. At the level Riserva can arrive everyone, also the industry, also the producer purchase the grapes and the wine. For this reason, we do the third level Gran Selezione. Third level is integralmente prodotto. I mean, every grapes, every wine come from the property. You can stay also if you are in industry, but only for the wine come from your specific vineyard. And this is just something a little bit more. And we start to sell this wine 30 months later the harvest. And so it's 6 months more than the Riserva. And the principle I try to do is this. Every producer, every viticulture know very well where is in your property, where is the best place. And so if you are you to make my zonazione? Are you said this is the best because this is come from this vineyard? Or and in the future, if we continue in this kind of idea, probably we can put the picture of the best part of the region. I think for the moment is a new room, is an empty room. It depends on what we put inside. But if we put seriously the best, probably in next 5 or 10 years, we have to have this kind of zonazione, natural zonazione, not zonazione come from the high, no?
Did you find as head of the Chianti Classico Consortio that Chianti Classico faces challenges with perception in the market? With how people understand it,
Chianti, we have the always the same problem. When I start in the 80s, the problem was Chianti. Chianti is one wine. It's really rare for the customer to know what is the difference between Chianti and Chianti Classico. And that's remain the great problem. Probably the good customer, the good connoisseur of the wine recognized this because the market give the difference with the money, with the price of the two level of wine. Chianti have a certain price, Chianti Classico is another price. And also the cheap Chianti Classico cost more than the cheap Chianti. And so this is an indifference. And so in terms of quality, probably some customer know this difference, but anyway, for the mostly part of the customer, we have to explain what is Chianti, what is Chianti Classico. We are Italian. We are really problematic because Chianti, with the name Chianti, you can when you say Chianti, you say the name of the wine or the name of the place. The problem is the place called Chianti don't produce the Chianti wine, but produce the Chianti Classico. Because the Chianti is the ancient, the oldest part of the production of the Chianti. In the origin, we produce all the Chianti in the region Chianti. And the name is Chianti because Gaiole in Chianti, Ama in Chianti, Radda in Chianti, not Ama in Chianti Classico. It didn't exist a region-specific Chianti Classico. Chianti is the region where we produce the Chianti Classico. But in the end of 800 and 900 overall, the quantity of the Chianti we produce is not enough. And so the estate gives the possibility to produce other wine around the region of the Chianti. And later, in the 30, I don't remember, 30 of the last century.
The 1930s.
The Chianti, the wine product in Chianti is becoming Chianti Classico. And the other wine Chianti produce all abroad, the Chianti called Chianti. It's impossible to understand, really. If you put on this also the Consortio and the Black Rooster, the problem we have had with the Black Rooster, I understand very well. It's very difficult to explain this kind of difference. The unique things we can do is the quality in the bottles. And the end, I know the is the name of the property, is the quality in the bottle, the typicity. This is the real characteristics better than the denomination. But I think for me the appellation is important because I don't like to be Ama in nowhere. I would like to be AMA in Chianti Classico. This is very important, because if you test my wine, you have to test the Chianti Classico wine, the origin of the place. This is the wine. I'm coming back to the what I said before. The wine is something connected very strictly with the origin. If you have the very noble origin like we have, it's important for you to understand where I come from. And this is our idea, this is what we follow for 33 years.
So what about Super Tuscans then?
Super Tuscan was very, very, very important wines overall in the past. Very important because give the possibility to the customer to discover Tuscany. Because without Super Tuscan, probably we are still with the Fiasco, the other things. But also, in the technical point of view, because with this wine, we learn to produce wine. The best wine we produced in the 80s was Super Tuscan wine. Later arrived at the Chianti or the Brunello or the other. Before is the Super Tuscan. It's the experimentation, because in my example, for we surgrafted in 82, 83 a part of the certain parcel in front of the cellar with the Merlot, because we watch what's happening in soil very similar to us in Bordeaux, and they planted Merlot and not Cabernet. And so we decided to surgraft a little parcel of Merlot with the right clones. This is another important thing, because at that time didn't exist any clones of Sangiovese. We have a selection, but it's a muscle selection. It's not really clones. I found to work for the first time with the selectional grapes, and we tried to work in the best way. Not only us, but all the other producers. And this wine was really something, is a flash in the wine market for the wine journalist, for example, for international wine consumer, because discover the quality of the place with this wine. And so this wine was very, very important at that time. The problem is, little a little for me, this wine changed a little bit the face, because before, well, the project is a wine out the appellation with the great typicity of Tuscan. This is a great Super Tuscan at the beginning. A little we lose. No, we maintain the quality. Probably we are looking for a long time, overall in the 90s, also the sympathy of the market. And so we go in the direction of the market, but we lose the Toscanicity. And this is a great mistake. In this moment, it's just a lot of year. We produce great wine, great super wine, but less Tuscan. And for this reason, for me, have lose a little bit the appeal for the consumer, because it's super wine. Sometimes it's also expensive, but super wine expensive is easy to find in every part in the world. If you don't give to the consumer the son of the Tuscan, the heel of the Tuscan, is they can buy the wine from Chile, from everywhere, Australia or other place. And this, for me, was the real problem. Was important because carry on all the denomination of the Tuscan, and it was important because we worked well, we worked better than the past. We discovered how to use the barriques. We discovered a lot of things, and so was very, very important. In this moment, I think we have to continue also with this wine, no problem. But we have to come back a little bit more to the origin. To the Tuscanicity.
And how do you do that?
How do you do? This is a great question. Great question. Because we should watch a little bit less to the ranking, watch a little bit less to the competition. The wine is not made for the competition. The wine is made to drink. And we have to produce very drinkable wine, very wine with the give the consumer the pleasure to drink. You know, in Italy, we overall in the past, we drink the wine since when we are 10 or 14 years with the water, but also in the family, the father gives the wine to the... And this is the pleasure of the wine. The wine have a certain value. We have to respect this value also in this wine. We don't follow the direction of the competition because this is not... The wine is not born for this. It's another things.
So you make a Merlot.
Yeah.
And how has that changed over the years in terms of your own perception of it? When did you start making it and what is it like to make it today?
Allora, we start to make the Merlot in 85. 85 is the first label of Aparita. We surgrafted, I said, on the vineyard of 7-8 years in between 82 and 83. Was for a long time this Merlot is becoming our flagship wine because people discover Ama with the Merlot. And that's, I don't know if my wife and I made a mistake, but we was happy because it's our wine. But in the same time, this important flagship risk to cover a little bit the work we did in the Sangiovese and in the Chianti Classico. And so for year and year, when the market asked us 2-3 times the production, we continue and we maintain the same production. We produce 5,000 or 6,000 bottles each year, no more. Because we believe in the appellation, we believe our efforts was to produce a great Vigneto Bella Vista, a great Vigneto La Casuccia. And when the wine journalists went to Ama for the Merlot, we test the Merlot and after we offer, but test my Chianti Classico. And probably with this political, we reduce a little bit the appeal of on the Merlot. But anyway, we grow up a lot with the Chianti Classico and the denomination. This is our result. In this moment, of course, Aparita remain a great wine. Is one of the best. He won a lot of blind tasting with the more reputed wine in the world. It's incredible. It's incredible wine, really. But and probably in this moment is also underpriced. But we work for the Chianti Classico. If you have to test our Merlot with the best Merlot in Italy or in the world, I'm sure this is a great horse, and this is a horse can win. But when I present you my Merlot, your head go away to the Pomerol Saint-Emilion because the original place for this wine is Pomerole Saint-Emilion, is French, it's not Tuscany. And the wine I present you, and when I introduce you my Bella Vista, I am the original and the other is the copy. There is a great difference.
At one time you made Pinot Noir at Ama, and you also made the Cru San Lorenzo. And what happened to those wines? Because I don't see them anymore.
No, because when I start to work, the mostly difficult things to do is to have the good homogeneity in terms of quality, because the hill up and down, different exposition, different altitude. And when you enter in the cellar after the fermentation, test the different vats, you have the peak in certain vats and in the other is not so good. I need 14 years to arrive to make a good homogenization. And this homogenization I realize because we catch the Sangiovese in the bad place and the Sangiovese remain only in the same altitude, in the same exposition, and so we can have this opportunity to produce the wine of the Chateau. In 96, so I started in 82, in 96 was born the label Castello di Ama. Castello di Ama is really our wine of the Chateau, is our flagship wine. Between 82 and 97, little I discover something more of each valley, I produce a single vineyard. And so 78 was Bella Vista, 82 was born San Lorenzo, 85 Casuccia, and 88 Bertinga. This is the fourth valley we had at the time, and we produced a single vineyard. But the project, I said, is produce not 10 or 12,000 bottles of good wine, but 100,000 bottles or 200,000 bottles of good wine. And so little by little, we improve more quality of the regular Chianti Classico. Cycling race, you have the groups follow the four people in advance, and little by little the groups arrived to catch the two not so strong. And so when the group arrive near San Lorenzo and Bertinga, coming back in the Chianti class, in the regular Chianti class, remain only the two more faster, is Bella Vista and Casuccia. In 96, when there was born the label Castello, of course, the space for these two crew is a little bit more smaller. I have to produce better, but when you make just so level of quality, it's very difficult to make this. For this reason, after 96, I produced the two crews only in the best year. 97, 2001, 2004, 6, 7, and now the next is 11. And so these two wines exist, but didn't exist. Is only 5,000 or 6,000 bottles each, and not every year, because our expression is our best expression is Castello di Ama. With the new appellation now, with the Gran Selezione, we have. I said we never purchase nothing grapes or wine, and so every wine, every bottle of our wine can be Gran Selezione. But we put in this big level the Castello di Ama and also the two crews, Bella Vista and Casuccia. To recognize this, now this is the new name. The 2010 is the first new Gran Selezione of Castello di Ama, is coming back to the name San Lorenzo. And so Castello di Ama 2010 is called San Lorenzo. It's not Vineyard San Lorenzo, but San Lorenzo, because is the name, is the name generally speaking, and inside you can find the grapes from the Vineyard San Lorenzo and also the other vineyard. And so in this moment our pyramid is made with Ama, is a simple wine, the first level of wine, and this wine is made by the more younger vines, easily to drink with the respect of the origin. You can test always Ama, of course, but in a more simple way. And later you have Castello di Ama San Lorenzo, is the Gran Selezione, and when I can, the two vineyard selection. This is our pyramid.
Because you don't make the vineyard selections every year.
Yeah. This is the problem. Otherwise, it's simple. No, you have. We don't have any reserva for the moment, because at the beginning the Castello is becoming reserva, but now with the new appellation, we prefer to call this Gran Selezione. It's our best expression, of course.
And where do you see things progressing in the next 20 years at Castello di Ama?
Oh, dear. I hope to be there for the next 20. No, we are working for our children. We have, Lorenzo and I have three children, and 17, 15, 12 is very young. We hope one of these three or all these three can follow the our work continues, because for me one generation to produce wine is not enough. As I said before, something work we did in the past now is not so true. I spoke, for example, with some producer of Burgundy and said the clones they selected in the 80s and the 90s is not good now. They continued to select the clones because now change the things. And so it's really amazing our job. We repeat for 30, 40 times during the life and change also the place where you play, you know. This is incredible. And so I hope, we hope, Lorenzo and I hope, one of the three children can continue. We try to arrive, to put Ama in the Olimpo of the best producer, not only of Tuscany, Italy, but in the world. We continue. For us, it's like a dream, because when we start, we watch the French is far, kilometer and kilometer. Now it's not so distance is a little bit reduced. We sometimes won also some blind testing, and so we can, our place can become one of the best places for the vineyard in the world. And so we work in this sense. I wish my children can do this for the future. I would like.
Marco Pallanti, he's made a project of explaining Gaioli in Chianti at Castello di Ama. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Marco Pallanti.
All Drink to That is hosted and produced by myself, Levy Dalton. Aaron Skella has contributed original pieces. Editorial assistance has been provided by Bill Kimsey. The show music was performed and composed by Rob Moose and Thomas Bartlett. Show artwork by Alicia Tenoyan. T-shirts, sweatshirts, coffee mugs, and so much more, including show stickers, notebooks, and even gift wrap, are available for sale if you check the show website, alldrinktothatpod.com. That's alldrinktothatpod.com, which is the same place you'd go to sign up for our email list or to make one of the crucially important donations that help keep this show operating. You can donate from anywhere using PayPal or Stripe on the show website. Remember to hit subscribe or to follow this show in your favorite podcast app, please. That's super important to see every episode. And thank you for listening.